Well, thank you so much for that introduction. You definitely have the best music. You also have the best titles. Freedom from Religion Foundation, the Emperor Has No Clothes Award, and Free Thought Heroine. I'm so thrilled with that title. I've been telling everybody. And of course, you don't only have a way with words in this foundation. This organization is one that frames effective actions in trying to ensure that our constitutional right to freedom of religion extends to freedom from religion. Actions are very important, but so are words, and I'm a writer, so I would never say that words are cheap. Words, especially searching for the right words, certainly costs me dearly. So I just want to savor for a moment the flavor of these words that you've applied to me. Free thought heroine. They're very sweet. And my being named a free thought heroine is also very sweetly for me a small vindication of one of the core assertions of one Steven Pinker in his defense of human nature. Steve, you probably all know from reading his books, in rejecting the blank slate metaphor for the human mind, has stressed the genetic contribution, not only in our generic human nature, but in our individual natures as well. When it comes to nature or nurture, it's not a matter of either or, as Steve has told us again and again in his best-selling books, but nature does often exert a very surprising hegemony over nurture. It turns out to be nature over nurture in very surprising ways. Well, this means a lot to me because there was absolutely nothing in my nurturance that would have led me to have ever been associated with a foundation like this one, much less being honored by it. In fact, in some sense, the a priori improbability of such a thing happening to me has induced in me a very strong feeling of unreality and almost imposterhood in accepting this very precious award. My birth family is very religious. It is Orthodox Jewish. I come on my paternal side from a very long line, 12 generations of rabbis and of rabbis' wives. Never want to forget the rabbis' wives. And I like to think that maybe there were some free thought heroines among them. My father, who was from Poland, had rabbinical ordination, but he was too self-conscious about his accent to sermonize for American worshipers and general lacked confidence. And so he became a cantor instead, as a result of which he could barely support his family. We were as poor as synagogue mice. We were four children, three daughters. I was inauspiciously positioned in the middle of those three girls. And the oldest was a boy. There were high intellectual expectations placed on my brother, who was expected to carry on the family tradition of producing Talmudic scholars. My brother, by the way, is a rabbi, and he always recalls to me one of my favorite jokes. You probably heard it, but Why was Jesus the perfect Jewish son? There are three reasons. He lived at home for a long time. He went into his father's line of business. His mother thought he was God, and he thought his mother was a virgin. Unlike my brother, I was a girl, and as a girl, there were no expectations for me other than I'd be sweet and docile, unassuming, and modest. Modesty, or sniut, as it's called, or snias in Yiddish, sniut in Hebrew, is the premier virtue indoctrinated into an Orthodox woman. I'd gone to an all-girls school in Manhattan, an extreme school, an extreme all-girls school, by which I mean extremely backwards. It was a whole collection of schools that were started, first established about 100 years ago. They were called Beis Yaakov schools, if that means anything to you. They were established back in Europe, and they were considered, when they were first established, radically progressive, since although Orthodox, they instructed girls in some of the sacred texts. And this was very, very radical. One medieval sage, in fact, had written that it would be better that the holy books be burned than that girls ever study from them. So this was a quite radical position back in Europe 100 years ago. We didn't, of course, study the Talmud, which is the intellectual zenith in Orthodox Judaism. It's the men folks' highest pride, the very means of conferring status among them, so that the best in Talmud are simply the best simpliciter. In fact, this is the standard used even in arranging marriages, which came as a great surprise when Steve witnessed this in my family. A brilliant Talmudic scholar, no matter what his other failings, can get a very desirable bride, most beautiful, richest, whatever it is that he desires. And I have sometimes, especially when I was younger, would play in my mind with the counterfactual. What would it have been like if I had been born a boy? And I know that I might have become immersed in the world of Talmudic scholarship, which happens to be a world of intellectual ethereality, demanding originality and deftness in splitting a hair at least 20 ways, which is, I confess, just the sort of intellectual exercise that I've often enjoyed as an analytic philosopher. I think I would have made rather a good Talmudic scholar. But there was, of course, no Talmud for us girls. Sniut, female modesty, on the other hand, was stressed to such an extent that in my high school, instead of having pop quizzes, we used to have pop hemline inspections. We would, and this was in the early 70s, so hemlines were quite short. We were supposed to be wearing our skirts down to mid-calves, and the, you know, teachers would come in, and we would have to stand up, and they would walk down the row of our desks, some of us tugging our skirts downward, and they would be checking our hemlines, and if your hemline was a little too short, you were sent home. But this was only the external sniut, the external modesty, inducing body shame, of course, but that was not the worst of it. Far more invidious was the internal inculcation of female modesty, which meant doing nothing to attract undue attention to oneself, including in one's very speech. There is a Talmudic prohibition against a woman's voice. This prohibition is known by the name Kol Isha, the voice of a woman. Men outside her family can't hear her voice because it is in itself, the Talmud says, an instrument of seduction. The law has been interpreted by almost all scholars to cover only the singing voice of women. In my family, this was a very active theme since, you know, my father was a cantor, we were all musical, and my older sister in particular had a voice, I think, that would have made her known in the greater world had she not been born a Orthodox female. It was, in fact, such an extraordinary, she has passed on, but it was such an extraordinary voice that she was actually given voice lessons by my parents. And when her teacher heard her sing, she said, "I have very little to teach Minda. God taught her how to sing." But that voice, which was professionally trained, was never heard outside our house or outside her own household when she got married, and she would sing lullabies to her children. Kol Isha is almost always interpreted as referring to a woman's singing voice, but there is a Talmudic discussion as to whether Kol Isha extends even to a woman's speaking voice. I quote here from the Journal of Halakha. Halakha means Jewish law. Quote, "Perusal of the Talmudic sources thus establishes the undisputed principle that a woman's voice is ervu." Ervu means an instrument of sexual incitement. I continue with the quote, "but leaves unclear whether a speaking or a singing voice is intended. And in fact, some authorities do ban even the speaking voice of a woman," unquote. To come from a background like that, in which such questions are even debated, even if the more liberal interpretation, which prohibits only a woman's singing voice, is accepted, is to have a very special set of problems in attaining one's personal freedom from religion. Imagine, if you can, how difficult it is for me to speak up. The special hurdle of convincing myself to overcome the embarrassment of undue attention. Whether it's in the fray of philosophical combat, and philosophy happens to be one of the most combative academic fields, or before an audience such as this one. And then, of course, I'm a writer, and writers are supposed to be engaged as least as much as in writing as in self-promotion. And this is a difficult thing in the life that I've chosen for myself. This was my nurturance, and it was intensified in that high school, that abominable high school that I went to. It was, however, an accredited school. Not all of these religious schools are, but it did have accreditation from New York State, which meant, and I have to say hallelujah, it meant that we were required to take the New York State Regents exam. I am so grateful for that. Because it meant that there was some control over the secular curriculum. I really consider those religious schools which don't have accreditation, and there are a slew of them, to be a form of child abuse. And I wish they could be outlawed. In 10th grade, when I took biology, our rabbi principal came in very seriously and spoke to us on the first day of class to warn us that the teacher, who was a moonlighting public school teacher, almost all of the secular teachers were moonlighting public school teachers, was required to teach us the theory of evolution because it was going to be on the Regents exam, but it was only a theory, which means unproved. And since it contradicted the story of creation that we all knew was true, we should learn the theory for our tests, and then we should forget all about it. But, of course, the explanatory elegance and power offered by that theory, as well as the explanatory elegance and power of the atomic theory of underlying chemical reactions that I learned in my chemistry class. We had no physics in our school, so that was as close as I got. In contrast to the explanatory vacuity, the just emptiness of such things as I learned most of the day in what we called our Limude Kodesh, our holy classes, meant that I forgot nothing of what I learned about evolution or chemistry, but I forgot almost every bit of convoluted nonsense I learned in my holy classes just as soon as I had taken the test. We were actively discouraged from going on to college, especially those among us who were considered the best students. But instead, we were urged to go to a seminary that was connected with the high school and was a sort of way station to bide our time until the all-important event in our lives, which would be getting married. But I did go to college eventually after I got married. I got married very young the first time. Eventually, I transferred to Barnard, which is the place I think of where I was born into consciousness. And it was, for me, the first time I experienced what it was like to have my nature nurtured. I could study anything I wanted, even the subjects considered mostly for boys, which was math and physics. I have to say I was a little disappointed that that category, things that were considered mostly for boys, existed even outside of that insular world that I was trying so hard to escape from. But at least I could study those subjects. Nobody was saying I couldn't. Nobody was going to burn the books before I got to study them. And my professors were all very encouraging. And then, of course, there was philosophy, which I got into because I was interested in philosophy of science and philosophy of math. I was learning very strange and baffling things in my physics classes, especially quantum mechanics, and I wanted to understand what these theories meant to be saying about the world that we live in, about reality. There are outstanding questions in the foundations of quantum mechanics. They exist still, and often when I would ask my professors, I would get a version of the answer that one physicist said is sort of, it's the standard answer that you get in physics classes when you ask, what does this all mean? Shut up and calculate. You know, don't ask what it all means. I was also interested in questions about foundations of mathematics. Mathematics is so different from all other knowledge. You know, it's a priori. We can prove things conclusively. It's immune to empirical revision. And this was both wondrous to me, it's a fantastic thing, but surprising what was going on here. And the more I bothered my professors about this, the more they said, why don't you go ask the philosophers about this? This is the sort of thing that philosophers take up. So I went to the philosophers, and I found something in philosophy. I found a lot in philosophy. Because it was while I was studying philosophy that I came to understand, and I have to say, for me, this had the feel of salvation, that it is no sign of moral or spiritual strength to believe that for which one has no evidence. Neither a priori evidence, as in math, nor a posteriori evidence, as in science. Quite the contrary. It's a violation, almost immoral in its transgressiveness to shirk the responsibilities of rationality, the obligations that are placed on us by being propositional creatures, able to formulate truth-valued propositions, to consider them, to reflect on them, to assert them or deny them, and then to act on our considered beliefs when those beliefs are such as to support actions. Bertrand Russell, who is one of my heroes, said about the practice of postulating in mathematics, quote, "The method of postulating what we want has many advantages. They are the same as the advantages of theft over honest toil." And one can very easily adapt Russell's statement about postulating in mathematics, and when I know that he wouldn't mind, uncompromising atheist that he was, so that it describes not what's so wrong postulate in mathematics, but what's so wrong about an epistemology that sacralizes faith, which is what religious epistemology does. So, to paraphrase Russell, the practice of believing on faith what we want has many advantages. They are the same as the advantages of theft over honest toil. Now, I've been hanging around, as Steve said, these atheist circles, many organizations for a long time now. And it seems to me, especially coming from the background I do, that some of my fellow atheists, underestimate sometimes the intellectual sophistication of religious believers, speaking of them all as if they're just dim-witted. And they're wrong in this, and I know that they're wrong, because there are people in my family whose IQs I would match against anyone's. They're not dim-witted. They don't require that we enlightened ones point out the fallacies of their arguments in favor of their religious beliefs, because they eschew religious beliefs. They're they don't eschew religious beliefs, but they do avoid arguments. They're too sophisticated to believe in arguments. My last book was called 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction, and of course that subtitle was very important. And when I was on my book tour, and they would announce, in various places that I went, the title of this book, they would often leave off that subtitle. So it was just 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, and I would often have very enraged audiences. I mean, they thought I was going to be, delivering a rejoinder to Dawkins and Hitchens, and I actually had interesting discussions with the audience. And there was one woman in particular, and it was in Philadelphia, in the Free Library of Philadelphia, and she said to me, she's listening, she said, "Are you actually saying that you're an atheist? Why would you just come out and say something so terrible about yourself?" You know, and it was as if, of course, I had just said that I eat babies, as one woman said there. And actually, in philosophy, we like more than anything dialogue, back and forth. It goes back to Socrates, of course, to 5th century BC Athens. And I actually ended up having probably one of the greatest dialogues of my tour, or maybe of my life, with that woman. Because, what I did was engage her and explain, as we went back and forth, it became more and more clear to her that she and I believed, had common ground, that both of us believed in objective morality and right and wrong, and we had similar ideas about what was right and wrong. And then when it was time for the book signing at the end, I see she's in line, and when she got to me, she didn't buy my book, but she handed me a little scrap of paper, and she said, "Well, I don't agree with what you say, so I'm not going to buy your book, but you seem like a nice lady, so I want your autograph." I consider that a great triumph because I was a nice atheist lady, and I think that, you know, was informative to her. Anyway, in this book, although it is a novel, I do attach this appendix, which gives 36 arguments for the existence of God, but with all of their fallacies. You know, first I lay them out in the way that we philosophers like to do, you know, very clearly stating the premises, and then showing what's wrong with all of them. And there are 36, which I think is more than any believer has gathered together. And there's all the classic arguments that philosophers and theologians have been debating for a long time, the cosmological argument, the ontological argument, the teleological argument, the moral argument. But I also wanted to formulate the vaguer and more emotive lines of reasoning that I've never seen explicitly formulated. So I have, for example, the argument from answered prayers. I think that's number 21 on my hit parade list. The argument from the intolerability of insignificance. I think that's a very important argument for many people. It's number 23. No, I'm sorry, it's argument... I mix them up. One is 21, one's 23. Anyway, I try to formulate all of these 36 arguments as clearly as possible, the better to reveal the fallacies that lurk in all of them. They all are faulty arguments. But part of the point of the novel, the storytelling that precedes the appendix, is that religious faith and religious adherence, at least in my quite intimate experience with it, very often has to do not so much with arguments. None of the Talmudic scholars in my family put much faith in any arguments, not even number 27 in my hit parade, which is the argument from the survival of the Jews. They see through these arguments just as well as you and I do. Rather, they put their faith, in the absence of compelling arguments, and they feel it an insult to their intelligence to have the fallacies of any of these arguments pointed out to them. It's a different level altogether that their religious adherence exists in, and so just combating these arguments seems to me doesn't get at it, and how one gets at it has been a major preoccupation of my life. It's a what we philosophers call an epistemological difference. It's epistemology is the area of philosophy that has to do with knowledge itself. What counts as knowledge? What kinds of grounds do we need in order to have license to believe? And there's an almost ethical, a normative component to epistemology, just as in questions of ethics, having to do with the evaluation of standards of what counts as right. In ethics, we consider what are the standards for evaluating actions, what counts as the right sorts of actions. And so in epistemology, we have the normative questions of what are the standards for evaluating beliefs? What counts as the right sorts of grounds of evidence for beliefs? And philosophy has been concerned with these sorts of questions from the very beginning, from Plato 2,500 years ago. It was Plato who stressed, as philosophers have always stressed, how seriously, how conscientious we ought to be in these matters of belief, as much as in our actions, not only because beliefs are implicated in our actions, but also if we want to get things right, if we want to know what kind of universe we live in. It was Plato who stressed how many irrational and subjective forces are always lying in wait to take the place of good grounds. These dark forces of the ego that incline us toward wishful thinking and fantasizing, coming up with visions of the world that flatter our own senseless sense of self-importance in this world, so that we come up with worldviews, with Weltanschauungen, that flatter our own egos, and that also incline us toward divisiveness, because we're all coming up with these views that will try to do justice to our own sense of importance. Here's something that Bertrand Russell really did say, without any paraphrasing, quote, "A habit of basing convictions upon evidence and of giving to them only that degree of certainty which the evidence warrants would, if it became general, cure most of the ills from which the world suffers." There's an ethics to epistemology. There's an ethics to taking our beliefs seriously. And this is a continuous theme in philosophy from Plato onwards, and it's why the spirit of philosophy has always been seen as inimical to the spirit of religion. In my school, there was nothing worse than to be a philosopher. The story of Spinoza was told to us as a cautionary tale. This is what happens, little girls, if you use your brains too hard, I guess. If you work here, if you ask the sorts of questions that you're not supposed to ask, and the story was told to us in all the gory details, from his excommunication from his Jewish community at the age of 23 to his being castigated by Greater Europe up until the time of and into the age of the Enlightenment. My school was with it enough to realize that philosophy was somehow hostile to what it was trying to inculcate in us, which of course got me very interested in philosophy from the very beginning. These epistemological and ethical considerations are part of the sphere of reason, even though they're not strictly part of science. They're part of philosophy, and there's an overlap between science and philosophy, but philosophy and science are not completely congruent. And I think we shortchange reason, and this sometimes happens in the atheist movement, when we identify reason only with the empirical sciences. Reason definitely has science at its disposal, but it has more than only science. And we have more in our arsenal. We have philosophy, philosophical reasoning as well. And this is also true in when we consider the fact-value distinction. Many religious accommodationists exploit this distinction. Most famously, of course, Stephen Jay Gould, who magisterially proclaimed the existence of the non-overlapping magisteria. I think this is nonsense, but it sounds awfully good. And it's often abbreviated as NOMA, right? Non-overlapping magisteria. And these two overlapping non-overlapping magisteria that Gould laid out were both, he said, mutually exclusive and co-jointly exhaustive categories of propositions. On the one hand, we give to the authority of the empirical science the dominion over all facts of the matter, things which are either true or false. And on the other hand, we give over to the authority of religion dominion over all values. So that this distinction between facts and values is a distinction here between science and religion. It's religion, in other words, which is to tell us how we are to live our lives, what are the values that matter, what it is to live a life well lived. There is no work, according to Noma, for reason to do here at all, according to this divvying up of Noma. And so we have to leave it to the authorities of religion and religious codes of ethics. Someone like Stephen Jay Gould can think that reason has nothing to say on matters of value, only because, with a certain degree of arrogance not unknown to scientists, he equates reason with the empirical sciences, which makes it almost unavoidable then to hand over to the authority of non-reason, also known as religion, all things having to do with value. Noma ignores the long history going back to Plato and Aristotle and onward to Spinoza and Kant and Hume and into our own day, Rawls and Thomas Nagel, which has been steadily offering us trickle-down arguments establishing the foundations of morality in reason. Steve gave away a little bit of how I think that this is done, and I believe it is done, and I believe that this is what has helped to remake our world into the moral, more moral place that it is. There is, of course, a lot of disagreement among philosophers. Philosophers are split up into the camps of Kantian deontologists and Millesian utilitarians, arguing whether there are certain acts, for example, torture, which Kantian would say is wrong intrinsically in and of itself, whereas a utilitarian would say no acts are wrong in and of themselves. You have to look at the consequences of them, which acts conduce to the greatest good of the greatest number. There's tremendous amount of controversies here, very important questions. But there is more agreement than not beneath the schisms. There is no disagreement that the moral point of view requires a certain disassociation from one's own situation, that insofar as one is being moral, one ought not to allow one's own particular identity in the situation, what you have to win or gain from that situation, be decisive, but rather we're required to abstract as best we can from our own self-interested point of view and see ourselves from the vantage point of just one among the many. In fact, Kant's famous categorical imperative that before you perform any action, you should try to perform this test in your mind, could you universalize it, make it a rule for everybody to follow, is really getting at this disassociation. This is a test that one performs so that you can see whether you're giving undue weight to what you have to gain in this particular situation, just as utilitarians and asking us to consider the greatest good for the greatest number ask us to inhabit this impersonal point of view, which is the moral point of view. And this is, you know, something that has been refined and argued about, but there's a tremendous amount of agreement here among philosophers, and this has made the difference. It has trickled down. It's trickled down even into religion, so that people read the Bible differently now, according to moral arguments that have been brought to them through secularism. I think this is very important to think. If we really want to give the full authority to reason, then when we have to take into account the work that philosophers have done as well, not just as important as they are, and as important as I've always felt them to be, the empirical sciences. More has been established in the world of values than we give secularism credit for. For example, it's a fact that slavery is wrong. It's a fact, despite the fact that no religion was able on its own without the input of secular philosophical arguments to discover that fact. It's a fact that slavery is wrong despite the many laws concerning the keeping of slaves that are to be found in the books of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Just as it's a fact that the voice of a woman, whether speaking or singing, is not to be regarded as in itself a sexual incitement. And if it is so regarded, that's not the moral problem of the woman who's speaking. It is, of course, the problem of the men who hear it as intrinsically sexualized, who can't abstract from the form and consider the content on its own terms. In any case, I thank you very much for listening to this woman's voice.